You are listening to the BBC World Service. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with NewsHour.
Bonjour à tous. Des perquisitions sont menées depuis ce matin à l'archevêché de Malines-Bruxelles. Elles sont liées à une enquête pour des faits de pédophilie.
Not the BBC, but Belgian radio announcing a series of police raids today. And a spokesman for the Brussels Prosecutor's Office explained it all. He was Jean-Marc Meilleur. He said the palace of the Archbishop of Brussels-Mechelen, just north of the capital, had been sealed off, and that prosecutors were looking for material relating to allegations of paedophilia.
This is a case that the Brussels Prosecutor's Office received recently, containing a statement of facts in relation to alleged sexual abuse of minors by a number of people within the church. The aim of the searches is to check the statement and gather evidence about these claims.
So the raid on the Archbishop's palace was just one. There were, in fact, three in all, and our Brussels correspondent Johnny Diamond told me all about them.
Yes, the news about the raid on the palace came first, but then very quickly it transpired that there have been three presumably coordinated raids across the day. First the palace, also the commission investigating allegations of child abuse within the Catholic Church, which has been up and running for around a decade, was raided. 500 files taken from there. And then, I think probably most sensationally, if you will, was the raid on the home of the former leader of the Catholic Church, Cardinal Daniels, who has been accused of failing to act on information that he received about a child abuse case. He says that he cannot remember ever receiving such information. But all three raids, driven by the prosecutor's office, assisted by the police, sort of some drama of the palace at Mechelen being entirely sealed by police officers, and clearly in a linked effort to drive forward an ongoing investigation into child abuse in the church.
Well, exactly. That sounds like the prosecutor's office has decided that the church and this commission just aren't moving quickly enough, so it's going to intervene.
I wouldn't want to go so far at this point simply because the prosecutor's office have offered almost no comment. The church has made almost no comment. At the moment, it's a bit speculative to say why the prosecutor's office acted on this day. That having been said, it's pretty clear that investigations which have been rumbling around are suddenly kicking into a much higher gear. We'll have to wait and see whether anything comes out of it. But at the moment, the focus of attention is actually on this commission, because the director of the commission spoke out, a man called Peters Andriansens, and complained bitterly about the seizure of files. As I said, 500 files were seized. 100 of those, he said, were, in theory at least, protected after requests of confidentiality, and assurances were given about confidentiality as well. They have now gone, and a clearly very unhappy Peters Andriansen said he now doubted the worth of the commission's work in the future.
Cette semaine, nous avons commencé 500 dossiers.
This week we began work on 500 files. We expected to finish our work by the beginning of October. Today we are a commission without any files, without any equipment. We're really shocked by the fact that all our files have been confiscated without anyone asking us a question, without knowing what this is about.
So, Johnny, it does seem slightly odd, this, because basically, although it's an independent commission, in a sense that's one arm of the state complaining about interference from another arm of the state.
It's a very odd day. You know, you rarely see this level of focus on what is effectively a prop of the Belgian state, you know, the Catholic Church here. And it's hardly surprising there hasn't been much in the way of clear explanation, because this is shrouded in the secrecy of judicial investigation. What's pretty difficult to divine is what the point of the commission is anymore, now that, as I say, its confidentiality has been broached, and also its files have been taken away. And that was echoed, if you would, by the head of the commission, again, who pondered what the future of his organisation might be.
Ce travail est anéanti, même si les dossiers retournent demain.
Our work is completely destroyed. Even if we get the files back tomorrow, what will it mean for the people concerned? That in 2 weeks I can invite you to come back because another investigating judge could decide to seize our files? What must I tell a victim who tells me, I want to come and talk to you, but it must be discreet? How can we guarantee this? For now, I have no idea.
Well, a very unhappy Peters Andriansons there, and that was Johnny Diamond reporting. Now, the Israeli blockade of Gaza has dominated the news in recent weeks from the Middle East, but in the West Bank, a rather different kind of closure has been causing problems for some years. In Sheikh Saad, it's a small town of around 3,000 people, a short distance from Jerusalem. Our Middle East correspondent, Tim Franks, reports.
In front of me is the village of Sheikh Sa'ad, just southeast of Jerusalem. It's only a short drive from the centre of the city. Indeed, it lies within Jerusalem's official municipal boundaries. But it's an isolated spot, partly because it's surrounded on three sides by the steep slopes of the Kidron Valley. What makes its isolation complete, though, is what lies here on its fourth side, its western side, and that's Israel's separation barrier. Erected around 7 years ago in an effort, Israel says, during the Second Intifada to stop violent attacks by Palestinians against Israelis. But this barrier has cut off this community of 3,000 from the very city which it's supposed to be a part of. So now what you have to do in order to get to the village is to get out of your car, walk up to the barrier and go through on foot. There is a traffic light here, but it's been on red for the last few years.
If you want to get out, you need your ID. You have it?
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Because Sheikh Saad is officially within the boundaries of Jerusalem, residents such as Ala Meshachre have to pay the local council tax. But Ala, an English teacher, says that he reaps none of the rewards. It can take him an hour on foot just across the checkpoint so that he can reach the school he works at, and he says he doesn't receive the local services he pays for.
Each year maybe we have to pay 2,000 shekel.
Which is about $500.
Which about, about $500.
Is that a significant amount of your income?
Yeah, of course, it's very significant. Life here is miserable. Our family, Jabal Mukhabar.
In Jabal Mukhabar, which is a district of Jerusalem.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult to go there. My uncle is there. My grandfather, he didn't see his son maybe 3-4 years because of this checkpoint.
We found Mohammed Ahlan going back through the checkpoint from Sheikh Saad into the neighbourhood of Jerusalem where he lives. Mohammed is 68 years old and is lucky enough to have Jerusalem ID, which allows him to go back and forth. He was carrying bags of vegetables with him, food which he'd bought in Sheikh Saad, he said, because it was cheaper. He also has family, though, marooned with West Bank ID, the other side of the barrier, in Sheikh Saad.
My father lives in this neighborhood. He holds West Bank ID, so I go to check on him every morning. Also, beside my father, there is another two brothers of mine. We've been separated. Now I ended up on this end, and the rest of my family on this end. Only 5 years ago, this separation happened. They have separated us, they have cut us off from each other, and all the family members are being cut off from each other.
The unusual thing about Sheikh Saad is that it's not just cut off from the bit of Jerusalem that's the other side of the barrier, but it's also cut off from a lot of the West Bank and the districts and villages to the east of Jerusalem because of the natural geography. And the road that leads out into those other parts, which I'm slogging my way up at the moment, it's a very steep slope, is impassable during the winter months because it's of such lousy quality to anything other than a 4x4 vehicle or a jeep. The only people who attempt to do this walk are students who are going to Al-Quds University, and this is a walk that takes them about an hour. I've only been doing it for a few minutes, and I'm pretty out of breath. We asked the Israeli military authorities why the residents of Sheikh Saad continue to be left the other side of the separation barrier, given that it's deemed to be a part of Jerusalem. In its response, the Ministry of Defence said that the route of the barrier was set in order to make things easier for the Palestinian residents, because if it had been pushed back into the West Bank, then residents would have had to ask for permission and go through security checks when they travelled from the West Bank into Sheikh Saad. In the recent tumult and high diplomacy surrounding Gaza, a small place such as this can easily be overlooked. But Sheikh Saad remains a symbol, just outside Jerusalem, of how lives in this place can be locked in frustration.
That report from Tim Franks. The World Cup now, and the holders, the defending champions, are out. And it wasn't that tough a group. Italy drew with New Zealand, drew with Paraguay, lost to Slovakia. They're going home. Economy class, I'd imagine. Alex Capstick was outside the stadium as the fans poured out after the match.
It's been a dramatic evening here at Ellis Park in the centre of Johannesburg. I'm just outside the stadium. Lots of very sad-looking Italian fans leaving and joyous Slovakian supporters who probably can't believe what's happened here. And to be frank, Italy probably deserve that. They didn't play very well today. They haven't played well since the tournament began. They drew their first two matches and then they've lost today. They've lost. They're going home. Massive disappointment for the Italians. I've actually got a couple of fans here to talk to us. We'll start with the Italian Giorgio, who lives here but moved over from Bologna. He won't tell me when, but it was a long time ago. Giorgio, what went wrong? What happened to Italy in this tournament?
I think there's too much money paid, not enough passion. They should walk home. You see, they would win very well afterwards. Disaster, disaster, disaster.
Why do you think they just didn't, they couldn't perform? They only did well really the last 10 minutes when it was all too late for them.
Sure, but their heart wasn't in it. You could see, passed to the wrong person, passed to nobody, didn't score, had no guts, and the opposition was definitely better. There was no two ways about it.
Well, let's talk about the opposition. I've got two Slovakian fans here who've been inside the stadium. Can you believe what's happened today?
Yeah, we knew we are going to win. Like, we're much better and we fully deserved it and we won.
Like, you knew you were going to win. You're smiling when you said that.
Yeah, come on. We were better. Like, from the beginning of the match, we were much, at least in the first half, we were much better. Except the last 10 minutes, Slovakia really deserved to win.
Okay, you're going to have a good party tonight?
Yeah, we definitely will.
Really happy Slovakian fans. This was a massive turn-up in Johannesburg. Nobody expected Slovakia to get through. Nobody really expected the Italians to go out. This is an ageing Italian squad. A lot of the players that won in 2006 are still in it. They're coming to the end of their career, but it's a sad way to finish and a sad way to go out of the World Cup.
Yes, indeed. Alex Capstick there. And coming up later in the programme, the lawyer for the families of the five American Muslims convicted of terrorism charges in Pakistan says the trial was not fair.
The United States has done almost nothing to make sure that these five get a fair trial over there either. You would expect, if American citizens have made allegations of being tortured in a foreign country which is our ally, that the United States would at least have publicly demanded an investigation and assurances one way or the other.
A reminder of the other news today, the presidents of Russia and the United States have spoken of a bright future for relations between their countries after wide-ranging talks in Washington. Prosecutors have entered the headquarters of the Roman Catholic Church in Belgium as part of an inquiry into allegations of paedophilia. And the longest match in the history of professional tennis has ended at Wimbledon. We'll be speaking to the commentator of that match later. Back to Italy now, not precisely Italy and South Africa, as we heard earlier, but Italians in Italy mourning their exit from the World Cup. And Beppe Severgnini is an Italian journalist, I think Corriere della Sera, and he joins us now. So from world champions to losers.
It happens. It happened to England, it happens to Italy, it happens to France, it happens to everyone.
Yeah, that's interesting. Is there a pattern of that, that you reach the top and then there's a collapse?
Well, if you look at Italy now and you look at France, 2000 and they won in 98 and 2002, they were a disaster. Italy's worst World Cup after this was 1974, after we did really well in Mexico 70s. It happens. Most of the time because you are grateful to the players who did so well for you and your country and your whatever. And there is a kind of gratitude. I think gratitude is a disaster in football and not only in football.
Well, you're saying that the management has gratitude and keeps old players on too long.
That's it. I think it happened. I mean, if you look, the Italian players who did well, Quagliarella was probably the one that could easily sort of ferry Italy to the next round, and he played half a match instead of three matches, and he scored, and every time he was past his man, and obviously he was cool and crisp and keen, and the others, and Gattuso was embarrassing. I mean, I was sad for him. I was sorry for him.
Well, what are people saying in Italy? You've got this sort of rather, clever analysis of it, but I imagine people have a more emotional response.
Not really. I think no one had expectations. We knew the team. Those players, especially the Juventus player and the Milan player, Gattuso and Iaquinta and Cannavaro himself and Camoranesi, they didn't play well. Some of them didn't even play. They were not sort of, they didn't start in their team. So no one knew why they should go to South Africa and become what they were like 5, 6 years ago or 4 years ago. To be honest, I think England did almost the same. But at least you played one match, which was enough. We played half of a match, and obviously that was not enough.
Yeah, and France played no matches.
And France, yes, absolutely. And France played
so all the
no
big,
matches.
All the big football powers are going down.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm convinced that I'm becoming not an expert, but I immediately say, like last month in my column, it's Argentina, Holland, and Brazil. Those three teams are doing well. If you look at the players, I'm an Inter Milan fan. I've been talking to BBC about Inter Milan happily this year a few times. And we have Schneider, we have Lucio, we have Samuel, we have Julio Cesar, we have Milito and everything and everybody else. So we are great team, but we don't have any Italian at all. So Inter champions, European champions, no Italian. Italians, no champions out of the World Cup.
Okay, so now here's a European culture question for you. If Italy's out, who do Italians support?
I don't know. I personally support Argentina because as an Inter Milan fan, they're all there, basically. And Holland, I like Holland. I always like Holland. And, of course, I know Capello. I like England. So I think you could do well because you had your scare. To be honest, next time I see Capello, I want to ask him, you don't need to be, Capello to know that Defoe is better than Hanski. But who knows? he needed to take his chance. But good for you. You are through and with Germany is going to be fun.
Thanks very much. Hedging his bets there a bit, I thought. Pepe Stefanini, thank you to you. Now then, let's have General McChrystal, who was credited with having crafted current US policy in Afghanistan. He pushed for and won the deployment of those extra troops in Afghanistan, shaped this counterinsurgency strategy that's being implemented now. But the planned offensive on Kandahar has apparently been postponed. So, he's on the way out. What is his record? Ian Pannell reports from Helmand.
White Horse right now is north on Donkey and south on Donkey.
Until February this year, Marja was one of the Taliban's main bases, home to hundreds of fighters and the center of a thriving opium trade.
Local nationals came up to 2-1.
The Marines arrived to drive them out and restore the rule of law and government to try and bring an end to a conflict that's been dragging on for 9 years.
Go, shoot!
The fighting's been intense and there have been casualties on all sides, including civilians. But the battle for Marja was more than just another military operation. It was a test case for America's new counterinsurgency strategy and the first piece in the puzzle of how you begin to withdraw these troops.
Ceasefire!
4 months ago, commanders predicted rapid success. But on the ground in Helmand, America's war is proving much harder and far slower. Today, military leaders are far more cautious. Brigadier Norton is the regional deputy commander.
I would say that we're about where we would expect to be. I think we're not perhaps where some might have aspired for us to be. And some of the rhetoric at the time was perhaps encouraging to think people to make people think that this would happen quicker than realistically it could do.
There has been progress. The local market is alive with traders and shoppers. Schools have reopened and new roads have been built. But winning the support of people who live here is a battle yet to be won. The Taliban use force, fear, and religion, and that's left most afraid or unwilling to side with America and the government it props up. There are queues outside the new town hall that show that some are ready to turn to the local governor for help. But the men squatting patiently in the midday sun are here to file complaints about the lack of security and jobs. Inside, there's an emergency meeting underway. Provincial leaders and their British and American sponsors have had to fly in to try and sort out the crisis here. Few of these tribal leaders will tell you that things have improved in Marja, and most, like Haji Matu Khan, have risked their lives just by being here.
I'm scared. If the Taliban see that I've been to meet the governor, they'll capture me and cut off my head. They'll kill me.
Yeah, we're still working on some of the roads. We've gotten some done, but there's still a lot of roads left in Marja that we have yet to work on.
We join the Marines on patrol, trying to get the support of villagers over cups of hot green tea. What they need from the foreigners in their midst, more than new roads or schools, is to feel safe. Hundreds of families have packed up and fled the fighting, many of them in the last few weeks. The farmer tells the Marines he's afraid to be seen with them. He thinks there just aren't enough troops to protect the people. That also worries the generals running this war. And some think it's why progress has been so slow.
The last update is that the enemy's egress. So you guys look behind.
Back at the Marines' camp, there's been a gun battle with the Taliban.
Let's go!
Inside the control room, the fight is monitored using high-tech cameras and unmanned drones in the sky. But as happens so often, the insurgents attack and then disappear seamlessly into the local population. Up on the roof, a Marine keeps guard. Mike speaks at the frustrations of trying to identify who is friend and who is foe, and says it's like fighting people who do it for a hobby.
We're fighting hobbyists. You know, they see Marines, oh, let's grab our guns, shoot them a little bit.
But how do you defeat that?
That's a great question. I didn't think you... Can you? I don't know. Not without killing a lot of innocent people, you can't.
So it carries on as it is?
I guess so. Can't we talk? Can't talk to them.
Shortly before he was sacked, General McChrystal worried that Marja is seen as a bleeding ulcer. There's enormous political pressure to show real progress by November. But there's now turmoil over the leadership of this campaign and a growing gap between what the politicians are demanding and what the military can deliver.
And that was Ian Pannell reporting there from southern Afghanistan. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with NewsHour. A court in Pakistan has convicted five Americans of terrorism. They were accused of contacting an Al-Qaeda militant in Pakistan over the internet and of plotting attacks. The trial was conducted in a closed anti-terrorism court, and the verdict and sentences then relayed to the media by District Deputy Prosecutor General Rana Bhatia, and we voiced over his words because of the quality of the recording.
Today, the court has decided this case, and according to the decision...
Today, the court has decided this case, and according to the decision, all five accused have been convicted, and the court has awarded 10 years in one charge and 5 years in other charges to all the accused.
Well, the five men come from the U.S. state of Virginia, and in the city of Alexandria there is Nina Ginsberg, who's a lawyer for the families of the five men. Does she accept the validity of the verdict?
I believe that the verdicts are based on fabricated evidence. I accept the fact that these are the verdicts, but I think that they're not verdicts that are based on real evidence.
And on what basis do you say that?
The information that I've received from one of the lawyers representing the five young men, he's given me, well, I guess you could call a summary of the evidence that they were able to show in the court, which totally undermines the validity of the evidence that was presented, for example, the emails and the telephone number that was supposedly used to contact someone who is an alleged terrorist. From what I understand, the lawyer over there was able to prove that the emails that they claimed to have found on the computer were made up. They all claimed that they went there for two reasons, for the wedding of one of the young men and to do humanitarian work. They all, except the young man who was getting married, all had return tickets. There was also a lot of discrepancy about the day that they were arrested. At the trial, the Pakistanis claimed that they were arrested, I believe, on December the 14th, but there were reports of them being detained significantly before that, I think on the 8th of December, and as I understand it, they were taken into custody. Whether they may not have been formally charged, but they claim to have been tortured during that period of time.
But you weren't in the courtroom. Did you try to go?
No, I didn't even. I did not try to go.
Because I think journalists weren't allowed in either.
Nobody was allowed in.
Yeah.
It was essentially a secret court that was held inside the local prison.
But they did have their lawyers. They were appointed lawyers.
They did have lawyers.
Do you accept that it is reasonable for Pakistan, if it believes an offence has been committed on its territory, to try people itself? I mean, it seems to be this assumption in the United States that anyone who's American should be extradited to the U.S., but that's not really reasonable, is it?
If the kind of trial that they're going to get is the kind of trial that these five appear to have gotten, then I would say the United States should be taking a position that they be tried here. However, as I perceive it, the United States has done almost nothing to make sure that these five get a fair trial over there either. You would expect, if American citizens have made allegations of being tortured in a foreign country, which is our ally, that the United States would at least have publicly demanded an investigation and assurances one way or the other.
Am I right in thinking there's a video they left behind in the States?
There was a video, yes.
Have you seen it?
I have seen it.
And what does it show?
Because it may be evidence in a case if they're ever prosecuted here, I'm not prepared to discuss what it is.
I think that severely undermines the credibility of what you're saying, doesn't it?
Well, I don't agree with you. I did view the video, and I don't believe that the video does not incite anyone to violence. You're not a lawyer, so you're not in a position to make a judgment about whether I think as a lawyer it's a mistake to publicly discuss something that may be evidence in a case.
And that was Nina Ginsberg, who, as she says, is a lawyer in Virginia. Now, governments around the world are inflicting some serious austerity measures on their citizens, and France is no exception. The retirement age is going up from 60 to 62 over the next 8 years. That will, the idea is, reduce pension costs and bring public borrowing down. But as Christian Fraser reports, there is going to be opposition to the measure.
In the country of the 35-hour week, where civil servants on retirement still receive 75% of their final salary for life, one phrase is sure to send a shiver down the collective spine. La rigueur. It means austerity. Not a term you'll hear from a French politician. In fact, they studiously avoid it. But France has been carrying a deficit for 30 years. And now it's time to pay it back.
It's crazy. So it means that we live above our means.
Denis Jamba is the co-author of a book titled Our Children Will Hate Us.
It's so comfortable to live with 35 hours of work, with 7 or 8 weeks of vacation every year. I think it's time to change things.
Last week, the government took the first major step towards reducing that deficit with the announcement of plans to raise the state retirement age from 60 to 62.
The opinion polls show the French are generally supportive of change and they understand the need to reform the pension system. But until now, Mr. Sarkozy's government has been very wary of talking about raising the retirement age. This is a country in which many civil servants currently retire at 50. And public sector unions like these are very quick to strike.
The workforce is already being mobilised. Thousands took to the streets last Tuesday, promising more action before the bill is debated in September. Paul Fourier is General Secretary of the French Transport Federation.
It's like French tradition, you know, to fight again and again since the revolution. So the government wants to fight with the union, and the union, of course, wants to fight with the government. So we will not find a good solution like that.
In the more peaceful surroundings of Versailles, economics professor Laurent Calvé shows me around his 17th century home.
Yes, so actually this is an old building.
Our surroundings serve as a timely reminder that France has struggled with debt before, and the gulf between haves and have-nots. 200 years ago, it sparked a revolution.
The French Revolution of 1789 was brought about by the large public deficit that the crown was running. So clearly we all remember that running public deficit is not a sure way to get a stable and productive country. I think the government is walking on this tight rope, and they're trying to balance the act by proposing some cuts, but not cuts that are so large that they would, scare the public.
The French government believes it can cut the deficit by some £80 billion over 3 years. £35 billion will come in spending cuts, another £30 billion in tax reform, and there'll be an end to any temporary spending designed to boost the economy. But some fear that won't be enough. Growth estimates look ambitious, and the fear is that health and education will also pay the price. Dr. Jean-Pierre Aubert teaches medicine at the Paris Diderot University.
We have the impression the health service in France is very, very good, but we are on the top of the hill and we are going to get down very, very fast. I'm very anxious regarding the health of French people.
Students like Emily Couchot, an undergraduate at the Sorbonne, worry there'll be more industrial action. Given state plans to eliminate 16,000 jobs in education this year, the unions are already spoiling for a fight. But it's not just her university education she worries about. It's that she's soon to enter the job market in a country where unemployment hovers above 10%.
I'm quite jealous of my parents because I don't get to be carefree as they were. So I think I'm going to have to work until I'm 70 years old.
It's the challenge that faces every government in Europe. How to push through necessary reform while containing the inevitable anger. The French Prime Minister has been frank in his assessment. No longer can the country spend indefinitely, he said. It's time for some honesty. Quite so. In the rest of Europe, it's called the age of austerity.
And that was Christian Fraser reporting. And the issues he raises there does also raise this question. Is the euro a flawed project? At first, the new currency did seem a triumph, a single currency that was accepted with remarkable ease by European populations and which proved itself internationally as a major currency and a stable one as well. But there was always a nagging doubt. If a euro government wanted to overspend, to spend more than the rules permitted, there was no certain sanction. And sure enough, some governments did that, to such a degree that many economists believe that to survive, the euro will have to change. Well, Niels Thuesen is a professor at the University of Copenhagen who used to be on the Delors Committee, and that reported in 1989 and basically came up with the first draft of the proposals that became the single currency without many changes, actually, from his draft. Does he accept that the current problems in the euro are a result of flaws in that original design?
I don't think so. I would rather say that they are the result of failure to implement the design that was made in the Maastricht Treaty, ultimately. Because the rules are quite defensible, and they are, in fact, now being reproposed again, this time with the idea that they should, in fact, be implemented as they are written. That is, the limits to public sector deficits and a norm for public sector debt.
I can accept that, but only to a degree, because surely, as a designer, you must have had in mind that politicians will break the rules if they can. There have to be sanctions, and there were no sanctions.
There were sanctions, in fact, envisaged for transgressions of the norms.
Controlled by politicians. So therefore,
controlled by politicians, but there, we tried to introduce, I think one can say, as much automaticity in the rules as possible. Certainly a presumption that a majority of the other countries would always want to uphold the rules, and that turned out to be incorrect. Mainly, I think, also because the group of countries, of course, became much larger than was envisaged in the early stages of monetary union. When monetary union was being prepared, the expectation was that there would be 5-6 members. And we started with 11. Now there are, from 1st of January next year, 17.
And do you think that was a mistake? Too rapid expansion?
No, I don't think so. In fact, some of the most recent members from Central and Eastern Europe, from the Mediterranean and Estonia that just admitted, are very virtuous in terms of the parameters, criteria for good policy.
So when you say you tried to introduce as much automaticity as possible, I mean, I think you're conceding probably there wasn't quite enough automatic sanction. And when we look back, am I right in saying that actually Germany and France broke the rules before Greece, Spain and Italy broke the rules?
There was a time in 2003 when Germany and France both broke the deficit limit, and they both voted in favour of not applying the rules to themselves, and they were supported by Italy, by Belgium, a couple of other countries. Otherwise, they could not have prevailed. But they did prevail. The Commission, in fact, took them to the European Court for breach of the treaty, and the Court recognised there was a breach. But it didn't propose the remedy of doing as they were expected to do to the two countries. So that clearly weakened the whole mechanism, and I'm sure today if there's one thing German and French policymakers regret, it is that they allowed the first sense suspension of the provisions of the treaty in a more formal sense.
Yeah, they sort of created a bad example.
They created a bad example. Then they did lead on the negotiations that followed, which made the rules a little bit more flexible, a little bit more like an annual negotiation forum for interpreting the limits. That framework is not necessarily a bad one, but if you cannot really trust the individual countries to do what they in fact commit to do in a group of European countries, it is a very difficult situation.
Do you believe the central European administration in Brussels will have to take greater control of national budgets to underpin the euro?
The main indicators of public sector performance, yes, they should have a role. And that was envisaged from the start of monetary union. And now, of course, the change in the situation is that countries have looked at the alternative to observing the rules more closely in the future. And that alternative is unmanageable debt problems, risk of default, or far more brutal adjustments that they would face if they had to follow the rules.
And that was Professor Niels Tewson there. Now, an alleged Jamaican drugs lord, Christopher Dudas Koch, has been extradited to the United States. He will be facing drugs and weapon smuggling charges there. This was a huge case. We'll get a reminder of it from the BBC's Nick Davis, who I think you saw him leave.
That's right, Owen. About 2 and a bit hours ago, in fact, I was down at Norman Manley International Airport. Lots of the people there who are probably heading away from the island after a break here will probably be completely unaware that the low-flying military helicopter which was coming in was taking away the island's formerly most wanted man. He was wanted in the United States on drugs and gun-running charges. The United States see him as a very big catch. They say he's one of the world's most important drug dealers. They now have him. He waived his extradition rights in Jamaica in a very quick thing in court. It was less than 20 minutes. So, you know, it may have taken 9 months to get the extradition off the ground, but it all finished very quickly and very swiftly.
And I think I'm right in saying that more than 70 died in the attempt to catch him. So how was he caught in the end?
In the end, he was detained by police who had intelligence. He was making his way into Kingston. It's believed that he was going to be trying to get to the US embassy to hand himself in. He was there with a negotiator, a man known very much in Jamaica, Reverend Al Miller, who was stopped with him. Within the last 20, 30 minutes or so, it's been revealed that the Reverend Miller's been charged with aiding and abetting a criminal, a wanted man. So this case is going to continue here in Jamaica. The controversy is going to continue. And many people are wondering why something which ended so swiftly and cost the lives of so many people couldn't have been resolved in a much better way than this.
Yeah, it sounds like a negotiated settlement, really.
Well, it seems as if, despite the fact that he was a wanted man, the Reverend Miller was trying to... He'd got a phone call from Dudas saying that Dudas wanted to hand himself in. He decided to be a go-between. He'd already helped bring in people who were wanted by the police, the brother and sister of Dudas, in the sort of weeks after the actual offensive in Tivoli Gardens in West Kingston. He was doing the same thing, but the police say that he was breaking the law, so he's been bailed and will return to court at some point in the future.
Thank you so much. That was the BBC's Nick Davis there reporting from Kingston. You're listening to the World Service of the BBC. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with NewsHour. And a reminder now of the main news today. The presidents of Russia and the United States have held wide-ranging talks in Washington and spoken warmly about future relations between their countries. A bomb explosion in Greece has killed a close aide to the minister responsible for counter-terrorism. The longest match in the history of professional tennis has ended in Wimbledon. We'll be hearing about that in a moment. And a police raid on an independent commission in Belgium on pastoral sex abuse of minors.
The prosecutor's office have offered almost no comment. The church has made almost no comment. At the moment, it's a bit speculative to say why the prosecutor's office acted on this day. That having been said, it's pretty clear that investigations which have been rumbling around are suddenly kicking into a much higher gear.
And that's Johnny Diamond reporting there from Brussels. You're listening to the BBC. So, the longest tennis match in the history of the professional game has ended at Wimbledon here in London. The American John Isner and Nicolas Mout of France were on court for 3 days. Yeah, the final set was 70 games to 68.
So, approaching 8 hours, and the records have just been tumbling the longer this game has gone on. She's a number 69, Nicolas Mahut. Averts what was his biggest crisis of the match. 80th ace of the match for Nicolas Mahut.
Let's go, Michael, at the moment.
Standing room only, as you can see, around court 18 at the moment. Boy, are they up for it, and are they ready for it? The scoreboard is working 59 games to all. They know what is going to happen. These weary warriors are going to make their way out onto court 18. And the sad thing is, you know, only one of them can win.
Nicolas Mahut, first serve is good, backhand return is good. Mahut digs it out from his feet. Isner goes for the passing shot. He's got it! He's got it! And he collapses on his back. John Isner, after 11 hours and a little bit of change, has won a record-breaking match here at Wimbledon.
There we are, some of the highlights with a bit of music. And after the match, an exhausted John Isner paid tribute to his opponent.
Hey, what more can you say? The guy's an absolute warrior. You know, it stinks someone had to lose, but to be able to, you know, share this day with him was an absolute honor. I wish him nothing but the best, and, you know, maybe I'll see him somewhere down the road and won't go 70-68.
We are generous in victory, and the commentator of this match was Ron McIntosh. It's a rather remarkable initiation for him, because it was actually the first Wimbledon match he'd commentated on for the BBC.
Yeah, it's quite a baptism.
It certainly was. How long were you on the microphone for?
I have lost count. Beginning the third day today, the time elapsed for the match was 10 hours. And, it's a comparative sprint today, so I don't even know what the final total duration of the game was. My head's just a jumble of facts and figures and statistics and records at the moment, but none of them are coming out in coherent fashion, I'm afraid.
But the thing is, you, at the end of the day, could get back up, couldn't you? I mean, if you needed to go and eat something or something or whatever, you could just get someone to come and commentate for a few minutes and take over. But the players...
Well, that's not actually how it went, and I'm not sure the BBC followed that policy, to be honest, because we started on day one, and we began in the afternoon, and that got to the conclusion of four sets, and I commentated on that, and then we began again 2:05 yesterday afternoon, Wednesday afternoon here in London, and that's what turned out to be the huge epic chunk of play, because bad light stopped play then, and the players only went for one bathroom break, and that was deep into the twilight. And so my co-commentator and I, Greg Rozetsky, we thought it was only manful of us to stay there and commentate on the action and the drama that was unfolding in front of us. So, and with all the football going on, to be honest, I get a sense that we were kind of forgotten about, because we didn't hear from anybody for a very long time. And then once the football had finished and the logistics had been sorted out and the two crucial games from England's point of view had been concluded, a production manager raced up and said, "Oh my goodness, are you guys hungry?" By which time I think we were beyond hungry. My intake for the day was a half an apple, a banana, and very little water because I didn't move for a bathroom break either, and I was just reluctant to drink because that would have increased the urge to go to the bathroom.
Good
so marathons
man.
Did
Good
for
man.
Us as well.
You were suffering for your heart. And I mean, what a cracking game. And so what's the story here? That basically they were obviously precisely evenly matched.
In every conceivable department, it was just absolutely remarkable to watch these two guys. And perhaps what was more astounding and amazing than that is that the quality of the play remained so high. There were so few chances offered on either player's serve. Eventually it was called off for bad light, and despite appearing to be suffering more physically, it was Isner who was protesting that he wanted to carry on last night. Perhaps a little bit of machismo, but they came out fresh and firing again today. And finally, it was Mahou who cracked.
Do you think he won't get over it? You know, that it was such a trial of his mental resolve as a tennis player. And, you know, with all the best will in the world, he came off second.
There are a couple of ways to look at that. Yeah, that it could be irreparable scarring that he suffers and he's never the same as a player again. Equally, the fact that he's been to such an uncharted territory in terms of searching his character and the depths of his soul, he may feel that nothing is beyond him and it could elevate him to a new level. I'd like to think, as an optimist, that it's the latter and we see Nicolas Mahou really rise now and fulfill his potential in his talent, because he's languishing down in the rankings at 148 and his talent that he demonstrated over the past 3 days suggests that he should be far higher.
Ron McIntosh, initiated commentator. And now we're going to hear from someone who played in the longest match in a US Open. And that's Michael Chang, back in 92. And you were on court, Michael Chang, for nothing. 5 hours and 5.5 hours?
Yeah, I think a little longer than that, actually.
Yeah, but it's still...
The US Open, we don't play the fifth set out. So, you know, it was a pretty long match with Stefan Edberg there in the semifinals. And unfortunately, I lost that one, so...
Yeah, but so what? It was between 5.5 and 6 hours, yeah.
Yeah.
And did that exhaust you for weeks to come, or are you so fit you just sort of shrug it off?
You know, I was actually pretty fit. I wasn't actually that tired. I don't think Stefan was that tired because you know, the semifinals and finals are played on consecutive days there at the U.S. Open, and you know, Stefan went on to beat Pete Sampras in the finals the following day. You know, I think that a 6 hour match is, you know, probably a little bit different than a 10 hour match. You know, I think the guys are probably pretty thankful that, you know, their match was spread over a couple of days rather than 10 hours, you know, all in one day. But, you know, still an incredible effort on both gentlemen's parts.
And the extraordinary thing is that the Frenchman, Mahou, went on after, I mean, just he had about 2 or 3 hours break, and then he was back on playing a doubles match.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're probably so far behind on their schedule. You know, it's very obviously. You know, sometimes at Wimbledon you'll have a, you know, a 17-15 or something in the fifth set, or even, you know, Mahou played a 24-22 in the last round of qualifying, but. The 70-78, I mean, you don't foresee something like that happening. And, you know, the first round match, you know, just finishing on Thursday is late. So, you know, he has to, you know, squeeze in the doubles matches. And, you know, I'm not even sure. I think, you know, John Isner may end up having to play a singles match tomorrow.
Really?
Break.
That's quite incredible, isn't it? Well, what do you think? Do you think there should be tiebreakers in the fifth set? Because that would put an end to this, wouldn't it?
You know, I think it really depends, and I think that each Grand Slam has looked at that particular rule very carefully. Obviously, the U.S. Open has chosen to go with the tiebreak in the fifth set. The French Open, they play out. The Australian Open, they play out. Wimbledon, obviously, they play out. I think it's a rule that should be played out, you know, for a tournament like Wimbledon, just because so much is relied upon, you know, the serve and holding serve. You know, if you were to put a fifth set tiebreaker in there, I think it would, you know, certainly shorten up the matches. But you know, a couple points here and there, a leg court here and there, can really, really make the difference. And you know, it would be unfortunate to be in a fifth set and have to lose because you know, someone got a lead cord or hit, you know, one or two extra, you know, great serves. And you know, I don't know if they're going to look at that any differently now, but, you know, still a match like that, I think is great for the sport of tennis.
Well, that's right. There's been a lot of interest in it here in the UK anyway, I'm sure around the world. So thanks very much, Michael Chang. That's it for now. Thanks for listening from all of us here. Goodbye.